Good morning, welcome back to Nach Yomi. Today we're going to be looking at Esther Perek Beis, the second chapter in the Megillah of Esther. This topic for today is going to be Esther being chosen as queen. So, as we know at this point in time, Ahasuerus has deposed of or killed his wife, and we now are at a point where the question is what is he going to do? So the first four psukim are the first section of three in our Perek, and in this section the king wakes up. His wine, his inebriation is worn off, and he remembers his Vashti, and he remembers what he had, the gzera he made about her, and the misharasov, his inner servants, notice that he's upset, and they make a suggestion. They say, look, let the king get all these besulois, tovois, mareh, fine-looking young unmarried women, and he should set up a system where all of them should be brought to the king, to Shushan Habira, and they should be under the hands of Hager, who would be the king's man in charge of this, and whoever you decide you like most will be, in fact, the new queen. So, first of all, just an interesting point you notice over here is that Memuchan, having made the suggestion, is not yet to clean up the damage. Yes, now the king has to live with the damage that was created by Memuchan's suggestion, and he has to swallow the fact that he bought it and understood that it was right and it was social justice, as Memuchan framed it, for all of society, but he still does miss his queen, and the people who fix this up or make the suggestion are in fact his inner courtiers. What is interesting is that, as Rav Amos Chacham points out, they are not actually diverging from Memuchan's original plan. Memuchan had said that it's important to get rid of Vashti in order to establish the dominion of each husband over their wives in their house. And what, in a certain sense, that dimension of power, of absolute power of the man, is what the Na'arim are really suggesting, what the Mesharas HaMelech are suggesting. They are ultimately saying is that the king, you also have the right to all the unmarried women in the kingdom, depending on who it is that you should choose. What is worthwhile just appreciating is we read the Megillah every year, and sometimes we just forget how barbaric and how ridiculous and how uncouth this suggestion is. The Gemara in Megillah on Yud Beis and Mubeis actually emphasizes this, and it quotes a pasuk in Mishlei which says, "Kol arum yaaseh b'das uksil yifrosh yiveles," that any person who will do prudently will act with knowledge, but a fool will unfold his folly. What does this mean? So it refers to two different episodes in Tanakh. David HaMelech was in his old age, was lonely, he was cold, and so his servants also suggested that he find somebody to marry, and that was Avishag, who was a young girl. But there was only a suggestion to find one person. Here, the contrast that to the suggestion of the Mesharas HaMelech in this case, they say basically that the king have a relationship with all the unmarried women that he can rate by a certain number or look, and ultimately whoever he wants to marry, well, he will keep. But this is going to damage all of society, and it's going to create a terrible trust issue and abuse issue with the king. Most people want to try to hide their daughters from the king. So the Gemara emphasizes just how couth, how barbaric this suggestion is, but nonetheless it feeds right into the power cycles of this particular individual of Ahasuerus. From Sukkim Hay to Chof, we now have this the episode actually unfold. We're told about an Ish Yehudi who is living in Shushan, Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish. It's the first pasuk we read all out loud in Megillah as a whole to emphasize this point. He is one of those who are exiled, or with those who are exiled from in the times of Yechoniah and Nebuchadnezzar, and he has this young lady, he's looking after this young lady called Hadassah, also known as Esther, who is his niece. She's orphaned from her parents, and she's very beautiful. He looks after her. When he hears about this edict that all young women who are attractive are going to be taken to the king of the palace, the king's palace, she actually is taken in this, and he tells her that she should not reveal her identity, her culture, and she in fact follows through. And it describes all the necessary preparations that these women would undergo before seeing the king. 6 months of preparation, all these fragrances, and all this perfume. And she really actually requested none of this. She would have none of this or these accolades. She wasn't interested in this. But nonetheless, when she comes to the king, she is selected in the month of Teves. She is brought to the king, and is read in a special chop. Va'yahav ha'melech es Esther mikol anashim. He loves her among all the other women. Va'tisachen v'chesed lefonav, and that she finds favor and grace in front of him from all other besulois, all other young ladies. Va'yosem kesem achus b'roshav yivnechel tachas Vashti. He replaces Vashti with her. And he throws a large feast for her, and he gives a tax break for all the kingdoms. And then there's a strange pasuk in Pasuk Yotes, which talks about Uvikaweiz b'Zolos Sheni Zomordechai Yoshev b'Shar HaMelech. And when the girls were gathered up a second time around, Mordechai is sitting at the Shar HaMelech, and Esther still does not reveal her identity. A little bit of a strange ending there. So just a few points to ponder. Who is Mordechai? So when we read that pasuk, which is read in the trop of Eicha, in the cantillation of Eicha, Asher Hagla Mirushalayim, Im Hagoyla, Asher Hagla Sal, Yem Yechonya, Melech Yehuda. So what's that referring to? That there was actually two stages of exile at the end of the first Beis HaMikdash. The first stage was when the nation of Israel started acting out against the Babylonians. That was under a king called Jehoiakim, and then ultimately Yechonya, his son. And what happened is that the Babylonians came in and they exiled. They took a lot of money out of Yerushalayim, and they took the 10,000 most talented people, artisans, out of Yerushalayim. Yechezkel was one of those people who was taken north to Babylon. But the Beis HaMikdash was not yet destroyed. They then put another puppet king who they felt would be more interested in the Babylonian interests, whose name was Tzidkiyahu. And Tzidkiyahu became the last king of Yehuda. Unfortunately, he too was susceptible to the false prophets and joined an alliance against Bavel, against Yirmiyahu's request, and ultimately brought the downfall, allowed the people to bring about the downfall of the first Beis HaMikdash. We're talking about the first stage of Golus, that Mordechai is attributed to being taken in. What is interesting also, if you look at the pasuk of attribution of his name, you'll notice there's a little bit of ambiguity. He's called Ish Yehudi, which means a person, not just a Jew. This is one of the first times you're hearing this term in Tanakh. It's not just a Jew, but he comes from the tribe of Yehuda. And Ishimini means he comes from the tribe of Binyamin. Remember the two southern tribes that remained, are not taken by the tribe, into exile, the 10 tribes of the north, were Yehuda and Binyamin. So is he from Yehuda or is he from Binyamin? The Gemara in Megillah, Davyud Beis and Beis, going over to Yud Gimel and Aleph, discusses exactly that. There's a few suggestions made. One suggestion is that he's a mixed marriage. Aviv mi Binyamin v'imoy mi Yehuda. His father was from Binyamin, his mother was from Yehuda. So that's what explains this. However, a number of the Tanaim discuss, the Chachamim suggest, that in fact there was a debate as to his lineage. Mishpachas Yehuda meres ono gorim demisyalid morcha deloy katle David l'shimi ben gera. The tribe of Yehuda said, you know, our ancestor David HaMelech did not kill Shimi ben Gera, even when Shimi ben Gera cursed David HaMelech in Shmuel Beis, thereby giving Shimi enough time to have children, and who's going to be one of his progeny is Mordechai. So Yehuda says, we take responsibility for allowing this to happen. However, Mishpachas Binyamin Amra Minai Ka'asi, and Binyamin says, but he actually biologically comes from our family. So they're both trying to take credit for Mordechai. However, there's another way of looking at this. Rava says, the Knesset Israel Amra, Le'idach Yisra, the nation of Israel, are actually rejecting him. They say, Luru ma'aso asali Yehudi ma'ashilem li Binyamini. Look what those from Yehuda did, and look what those from Binyamin did. Look what Yehuda did, because David HaMelech did not kill Shimi, then Mordechai was born. Mordechai was the one who did not bow down, causing this genocide to arrive. And the Mashinim Le'yimini, Delo Katle Shol La'agag, Disladid Minei Haman. But look, at the end of the day, they did not kill, Shol did not kill Agag, giving him enough time to have a child who's going to be, the child of Agag is going to ultimately, the progeny is going to yield a Haman. So that Knesset Yisrael are blaming both Binyamin and Yehuda for arriving at the troublemaker, so to speak, who's Mordechai, and the instigator, which is Haman. We've got to get to that as we get to the next parak. I appreciate this. Just to understand the complexity of the dual description of Mordechai here. who is Esther. So we're told that her name is both Hadassah and Esther, and she's adopted. It's interesting to note that she's given a denomination as Bas, as a daughter, and so he has a fatherly relationship with her. However, Chazal darshan that she's also Labayis, as a house, which means to say he adopted her not just as a daughter, but in fact as his wife. So we have these two dual-level relationships. The Ralbag, in fact, makes note that the word Hadassah comes from the word Hadas, which is a myrtle. And a myrtle is very fragrant, like we know in the one of the Arba Minim is the myrtle, and that it's very fragrant because Ma'aseh Yotovim. She had good actions. She wasn't just an attractive physical person. She was, in fact, a very good person, which is what the king also is noticing. The Medrash takes us one step further, the Medrash Rabbah, to note that although the myrtle is in fact fragrant, it is also bitter to the taste, which means to say that yes, Ma'aseh Tovim, that she was good, and to Mordechai she was good, but to Haman she was deeply bitter. She was a person who had goodness but also strength at the same time, and we're going to see that develop over the time of the Megillah itself. Why would she not disclose her heritage? Wouldn't that be a reason to get her rejected potentially? Maybe they would look down at the Jews, and maybe then she would be rejected and this whole episode could be saved. So Rashi says no, because what he realized was if she was not revealing her identity, she'd be taken as a pauper. But if she were to reveal that she came from the royal lineage of Sheol HaMelech, there might would be a reason to actually keep her. So that's why he avoided this. The Ibn Ezra has a little bit of a slightly different idea, and he said that, look, the king's primary objective here was beauty and lust. It wasn't about intellectual conversations. And so that being the case, because she was so beautiful, it was very likely that she'd be taken by the king. But if she were to say, well, you know, I am a Jewess, and I have certain boundaries about what I eat and where I go and what I do, the king was a man, as we've seen up till now already in the first parak, is a man who doesn't like boundaries. He doesn't like to be told what to or what not to do. And he'd make a fight of it, and he'd force her to eat this and force her to do that. But he realized that if she wouldn't say anything, then ultimately she'd be able to have the liberty to be able to create her own lifestyle in the king's palace, which wouldn't become a battle every time she would be doing something because of a Jewish tradition. It is, of course, worthwhile noting that Mordechai could have known that maybe it's a good idea to have a Jew in the cabinet, to have a Jew in a high position, and therefore he didn't. He wanted to be not dismissed. He did not want her ideas to be dismissed as being Jewish by the fact that she is Jewish herself. And ultimately, of course, we all know that in the end of the day, whether he knew this prophetically or he did not know this prophetically, this would be the key to the Geula, to the redemption. And so whatever his intents were or were not, this was in fact laying the groundwork for the future redemption of the nation of Israel. Which now leads us to the last fascinating point over here, is that you read the last few psukim in this section, psukim Yud Ches, Yud Tes, and Chof, about the feast he made and the crown and the tax recut, and they were gathering up the girls a second time. It doesn't seem to add up what's going on over here. So Chazal noted this, and the Pirush Yesha Elohim makes a very fascinating point. Rav Avram Zahalon, who wrote the Sefer at the end of the 1500s in Venice, he says a very interesting insight, and that is that Achashverosh is the kind of person who likes to be in control. And if he's not being told something, that feels like there's something he's not controlling. So he tried a number of ruses in order to be able to get out who she was. So what does he do? He throws a large feast for her, expecting that she's going to have an invitation list. She'll have family, friends who show up, who're so proud, they want to take selfies with her. And so at that point, he'll be able to work out where she comes from. Doesn't work. Feast doesn't work. So what does he do? He says maybe her family doesn't live in Shushan Abira. So he does a federal tax cut. So all the 127 provinces experience a tax cut because of Esther Amalka, expecting that now there's going to be people coming out of the woodwork and he'll be able to figure out who she is. That doesn't work either. So you know what he does? Is he gathers the girls up a second time to give the implicit threat that maybe her standing isn't so solid. But still, you're Mordechai Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech. Mordechai is there, and that's why Esther, once again, it emphasizes that she would still not tell of identity. She was so resolute, she was so able, she had enough inner strength of character to be able to withstand all of these attempts to make her reveal her identity. And finally, the last very short section of this perek, the third section, is Psukim Chav Aleph to Chav Gimel, with a failed assassination plot. We know that Mordechai is in the Shar HaMelech, and he hears about Big Son and Teresh, who get upset or are angry with the king, and they plan to Lishlach Yad, to assassinate the king, Manu Forshim say, to poison him, and it was known to him, and he in fact goes and tells Esther. She repeats it to the king in the name of Mordechai, and they are in fact hanged. And it is written down that Mordechai was the one who generated this salvation. So one question we can ask ourselves is, what was their problem? Like, meaning, like, what was Big Son and Cherish's issue particularly over here? So the Medrash says that, in fact, Big Son and Cherish were from the family of Vashti. So they felt that their family, Vashti, was really the real monarch over here, because it was her blood which got Ahasuerus to the throne in the first place, was being deposed of and being replaced by somebody who wasn't worthy of the title. Could be that under Vashti's rule, there was better wages and better options for courtier guards, and they were felt that they had been wronged, and they were going to take revenge because of this. If you want to take it one step further, Yosef ibn Yechia, in his sefer on the Megillah, points out that maybe it has to relate to Mordechai himself. And that is, they said, Mordechai is Yoshev b'Shar HaMelech. Mordechai has been hanging around because he wants to implicitly find out how Esther is doing. And so the guards start talking to him, and the courtiers ask him advice, and they find him, he's very agreeable, and he's intellectually very sharp, and they promote him, and they give him a job. And these guards now say, look around, and they say, wait a second. We work day and night, sweating and freezing through the summers and the winters. And this fellow over here has a conversation with some higher-ups and gets hired right away. That's unfair. So they felt there was injustice on that account, which is why they had this assassination plot. But ironically, that explains why it is that Mordechai has to reveal it as well. Because the question one has to ask is, so why did Mordechai just let this happen? After all, Esther, his wife or stepdaughter, essentially, or adopted daughter, is in the clutches of this monster. So why doesn't he just let Ahasuerus be killed? One of the answers is because it was about himself. The other answer, and I think this is important to notice, about the state of the diaspora Jew. Here we're meeting a new kind of Jew, not the Israeli, the Israelite who lives in the land of Israel as an Israelite. Now we're meeting a new type of Jew, a Jew who lives in the diaspora reality. And one of the things about the diaspora Jew is that they are painfully loyal to their monarch and to their government, even more than the citizens of that country itself, the Big Son and Tereshes of society. And this has been the role of the Jews, even though the pogrom is about to unfold, even though the genocide is about to unfold, Mordechai does such. But nonetheless, it lays the seeds for the Geula, and that's ultimately what happens. It's worthwhile noting, after looking at these first two prokim, that these two prokim do not relate to the actual drama of the Megillah itself. The genocide that's about to unfold is Perek Gimel onwards, when Haman enters the scene. These are the preamble to understand all the necessary steps that HaKadosh Baruch Hu took in order for the salvation to happen before the tzara, before the terrible decree even started. So just to appreciate the build-up to this point, where we're now about to actually start reading the drama itself as it unfolds. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.